On the program today, with apologies to Jane Austen, politics and tariff policy. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Wednesday, today the 20th of June. Good as always to have you along, everybody. And we take you now to the Senate Finance Committee meeting this morning. The senator from Kansas, Pat Roberts, with the floor.
Recently, the owner and operator of Shield Agriculture Equipment, Mike Bergmeyer, contacted me about the rising costs his business is experiencing due to steel tariffs.
What's that company?
Shield Ag is a small business in South Hutchinson, Kansas.
How small, Senator?
It employs 42 people.
All right, what do they do?
The company designs and manufactures and distributes tillage tools and hardware.
Wait, they make what?
His company uses steel from Manitoba, Canada, to make their Shield V blades.
Ah, steel from Canada. Now we're getting somewhere.
The steel is not available from any other mill in the United States, and due to tariffs on steel, Shield Ag's cost of production for this single replacement blade is $85,000.
Which gets us to the point Senator Roberts was making to the guest at today's Finance Committee hearing, Secretary of Commerce and Tariff Policy Point Man for the White House, Wilbur Ross.
I think a case can be made that these businesses are paying the price for the administration's negotiating strategy. Secretary Ross, I think it's imperative that you and your department understand the current impact, not only with regards to farmers and ranchers and the entire ag industry, but also the small business community, the so-called little guy.
And now, because you knew it was coming, the senatorial ask.
So when Mike called to and talked to my staff, he asked, who can I call? What can I do? I talked to him. I sympathized with him. But obviously, you can only do so much as a senator and also the chairman of the Ag Committee. I told him about the hearing today, and he made a request. And I made a request to you earlier, and I appreciate your response, and that is you give Mike Bergmeyer a call so you can hear firsthand the tough choices in small and medium-sized business are making due to these tariffs.
Secretary Ross did finally get a word in edgewise.
As I promised you before, I promise you now on the record, I'll call him no later than tomorrow morning.
The secretary was better than his word by a bunch. He called Mike Bergmeyer right after the hearing, and so did we.
I believe that when they first did the tariff, it was more of a broad brush, okay? I liken it to picking up a gallon can of paint and throwing it against the wall. Well, sometimes the curtains are going to get paint on them, too. All right? So they probably didn't realize the law of unintended consequences. I am that person.
He did say we should point out that he's ready for the Commerce Department to get its chance to get those exclusions and exemptions from the tariffs going. One more thing from Senator Roberts. For those wondering whether this is the way things happen in Congress, the answer is kinda.
If you could move him to the top of the list, it'd be great, but I think I'm not sure that that's the way we ought to do business.
More about tariffs and American companies trying to get out from under them on the program tomorrow. Literally ran out of time to do it today on Wall Street on this Wednesday. Sideways. Again, we'll have the details when we do the numbers. There was CEO news today to which, I am not going to lie here, my reaction was, Atul Gawande, surgeon, writer for the New York Magazine, occasional guest on this program, was picked to run the company that Jeff Bezos of Amazon, Warren Buffett of Berkshire Hathaway, and Jamie Dimon of JPMorgan Chase announced earlier this year. The one that's going to make healthcare work better for the million or so people who work for those three companies. Granted, Dr. Gawande is accomplished, and in the last couple of years, he has even run a lab testing new ways to improve healthcare. But a whole lot of way more experienced executives have tried to do what Gawande is now responsible for doing and haven't. So again, But from our health desk at WHYY, Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein has this look at why Gawande might actually be the perfect person to pull this off.
Atul Gawande's new job will be hard, but those who know him say being a scholar gives him a leg up.
My strong sense is that Atul is substantially less likely to be duped.
Amitabh Chandra is a health economist at the Kennedy School.
Because he's been raised in an academic environment, he's going to be very skeptical of people who promise something for nothing.
One reason Gawande's job will be so hard is because he has to chase what seems impossible provide better care at lower costs. Plenty of healthcare companies will try to lead him to the lost city of gold with their latest device or app. University of Chicago Dean Kate Baker says Gawande, as a serious researcher, will bring strong ideas to the job, like surgeons following checklists to reduce deaths.
The tool has made it a mission to spread best practices and to figure out which things can be implemented and which things can't.
We don't know much about Gawande's job beyond a press release, which says the new healthcare company is a, quote, independent entity that is free from profit-making incentives and constraints. Harvard Business School's Limor Daphne says Gawande's backing from Bezos, Buffett, and Diamond and their money is great, but she's still skeptical.
Because sometimes you start with really fantastic ingredients, but the souffle doesn't rise.
Daphne says companies falter in their quest to reimagine healthcare because they lack the commitment and the will to solve a nearly impossible problem, America's broken healthcare system. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
The NBA draft happens tomorrow at the Barclays Center in Brooklyn. Teams choosing from a group of mostly college basketball players looking for the next LeBron or Steph Curry, that once-in-a-generation player who can change a team's fortunes or at least get them closer to a championship. And most teams these days have a secret weapon that they think helps them pick the best players. Emphasis on think. Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson explains.
When you hire a kid right out of college, it's kind of a leap of faith. Sure, you interview them, but you don't really know if they're going to be any good at the job. The NBA draft should be different, says David Barry, a professor at Southern Utah University.
So this should be a lot easier. It's not, but it's supposed to be. This shouldn't be that hard.
Teams are mostly drafting prospects they've seen play in college. They've collected lots of data on how they perform. They've put them through workouts.
Information is basically perfect.
Alan Sanderson studies the business of sports at the University of Chicago. He says pretty much everything that can be known about these guys is known. But
in the distribution of championships, chance is non-trivial.
Maybe that coveted draft pick's knees won't hold up. Maybe he won't perform as well against NBA pros as he did against college players. Maybe he gets derailed by bad personal choices. Brent Evans at Georgia College and State University says the majority of number one draft picks do go on to be NBA All-Stars. But later picks truly are like playing the lottery.
Drafting, say, third or fourth is probably really not that advantageous. Those players, more often than not, are simply just run-of-the-mill NBA players.
Victor Matheson is a sports economist at the College of the Holy Cross.
Despite the huge amount of additional emphasis that's been put into quantitative analysis in sports in the NBA, there still seem to be just as many diamonds in the rough that are missed out on.
And just as many busts at the top of the draft, too. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
Real estate prices in California are high, and they are still going up. According to the California Association of Realtors, the median price, that's where half of homes are more expensive, half less, the median price of a single-family home in this state is now more than $600,000. Nationally, it's closer to $260,000. So, as California's prices rise, house hunters are heading east, farther out from expensive cities along the coast, and even out of state. From the nonprofit news site Cal Matters, Matt Levin has the story.
This is the sound of real estate porn for Californians.
What did you think of the Cape Cod house?
It's an episode of HGTV's House Hunters. In this one, a couple chooses between three obnoxiously nice homes in Michigan.
At the price of $265,000?
$265,000 for a five-bedroom, three-bath house on a lake. Not something you're going to find in most of California. At least something you'd want to live in.
Why do I have to go first, walk through cobwebs? You should go first.
San Jose realtor Holly Barr shows me around the backyard of one of her hottest listings. We're in a wealthy neighborhood of San Jose called Willow Glen.
Easy commute to Apple and Google and all the major companies in Silicon Valley.
It's a nice tree-lined street, and the house sits on a 5,800-square-foot lot. There's only one problem.
The fire started in the garage, and you can see a hole in the roof of the garage. Someone put some of the white picket fencing on top of the roof. The windows are pushed out. The door is...
Barr's not doing this justice. The house looks like someone left it in a toaster oven too long. It didn't matter. Last month, she listed the burned-out house for $800,000. It sold in 6 days for over $9 million. That median price of over $500,000 for a California home, it's not going to get you much in this part of the state.
In San Jose, maybe a mobile home, maybe a condo in not a great area.
San Jose is in Santa Clara County, where the median home price is now $1.2 million, up 20% from last year. That's part of the reason why more residents are leaving the region than arriving from other parts of the country, according to state demographic data. And a growing number are heading about 90 miles east on Interstate 80. Here.
Here we have the formal living room.
Sacramento.
We have a fireplace, electric fireplace here.
Ooh, with the fire going. Veronica Nelson specializes in showing middle-class Bay Area families how much more they can get farther from the coast.
I've had several teachers. They commute. Spend the night with a relative in the Bay Area once or twice a week and, you know, make the best of it.
More people moved to Sacramento last year than at any time in more than a decade. According to the Sacramento Bee newspaper, real estate refugees are coming from Silicon Valley and Los Angeles.
Do you worry that Sacramento is becoming unaffordable for people from Sacramento?
Yes. Yes. The people who live here, who work here, especially people in a certain socioeconomic bracket, cannot afford to buy here.
And where are those Sacramentans moving? Many are part of a growing stream of Californians that are hitching their Priuses even farther east on I-80.
They come in with an air of optimism.
Mike Wood is a real estate agent in Reno, Nevada. He says he used to get one or two leads a day from Californians looking to relocate. Now it's 8. Prices in Reno are rising fast. They've increased more than 10% a year over the past few years. But even at a median price approaching $400,000, that's not deterring Californians, according to migration data tracked by the IRS.
I can sense that they feel like they're coming to a place where they're not going to be financially oppressed.
And the more Californians come in, Wood says, the more pressure they're putting on Reno residents to look elsewhere for homes. From Sacramento, at least for now, I'm Matt Levin for Marketplace.
Matt's story was produced for us by the California Dream Media Collaboration. Coming up.
Because labor's expensive, land's expensive. So home builders, when they build homes, they build more expensive homes.
The ins and outs and zestimates of today's housing market. But first, let's do the numbers. Markets mostly stopped their slide today after fully digesting the threat of a U.S.-China trade war. Dow Industrials down a little less than 0.2%, 42 points, 24,657. You had to be listening yesterday to get that one, I guess. S&P 500 gained a little less than 0.2%, 4 points, 27.67. NASDAQ advanced 0.7%, 55 points, 77.81. Ladies and gentlemen, we have a bidding war. 20th Century Fox surged ahead 7.5% today on news that Disney has raised its offer to buy its entertainment businesses. 71 billion simoleons is the latest number. Disney gained almost 1%. The other Fox Hunter Comcast jumped 1.7%. Comcast has offered 66 billion if you're keeping track. You're listening to Marketplace. Not everybody gets a chance to learn about the economy in school. Marketplace helps you continue your education in a way that's smart, accessible, and hopefully even a bit fun. Your donation is not only an investment in your own learning, but also in helping us make more people smart about the economy, and that is good for everyone. To learn how you can help, visit marketplace.org/investors, and thanks. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. The United States has, since January, had a new tax code in place, as you know, a flattening of rates for individual filers, some other new provisions for people as well, but also a huge change for companies. The corporate tax rate went from 35 to 21%, in part, as the White House explained, to convince American companies to bring home more of their overseas profits. The European Union's working on a plan to thwart tax avoiders as well, which makes this maybe not such a great time to be a country that gets big benefits from what is euphemistically sometimes called tax mitigation. Ireland, for instance. So, with its all-important to the national economy tax practices under attack, do you suppose Ireland's feeling the heat? From Dublin, Marketplace's Stephen Beard is on it.
Ireland has many attractions. Stunningly beautiful countryside, clever, gregarious people, and, as you can hear in this TV ad, blarney.
In the 1800s, America was the beacon of undiscovered opportunity. That opportunity now presents itself across the Atlantic.
With marketing like this and a 12.5% corporate tax rate compared with 21% in the U.S. and with very generous tax breaks, the Irish have over the decades enticed more than 1,000 big, mostly American global companies to set up here, enriching the country.
The multinationals are a critical, crucial, essential part of our economy.
Tony Foley, economics professor at Dublin's DCU Business School, says these companies helped pull Ireland out of the Eurozone debt crisis.
Without the multinationals, we are much closer to Greece and Portugal than we would like to think.
The multinationals account for 90% of the country's manufactured exports. They employ more than 10% of the workforce. Conor O'Toole of the Economic and Social Research Institute says it also helped modernise and revitalise Ireland.
Many Irish entrepreneurs would have started their careers within these large multinationals, which have led to this kind of business dynamism and this kind of entrepreneurial spirit, which is a big boost as well to the Irish economy.
A bit alarming then for the Irish that many economists have greeted the tax incentives that lured the multinationals here with criticism and even ridicule. Invoking the most ludicrous figure of Irish folklore.
I'm a little leprechaun dressed in green.
Economist Paul Krugman called it leprechaun economics when a new tax relief led to an increase in Ireland's annual GDP of 26%.
I'll give you my big pot of gold.
Over the years, other oddities have emerged, like the so-called Double Irish scheme, under which, for example, tech giant Apple was treated as not being a tax resident anywhere. You might be forgiven for thinking that Shenanigans is a firm of Irish tax accountants. Professor Jim Stewart of Trinity College Business School says Ireland's tax model is in the crosshairs.
While Ireland benefits a lot from its tax concessions, other countries lose out a lot, and they're not happy with this.
The US has cut its corporate tax rate to 21%, down from 35%, to lure American companies back from abroad. And the EU is trying to deter multinationals from shunting their profits from around Europe into their low-tax Irish subsidiaries. Ireland is vulnerable, says Stewart.
This is very risky. If you're here for tax reasons, that means you're relatively footloose. So if the tax changes, you're more likely to be out of here.
Despite the criticism, Irish public opinion seems to back the tax-avoiding multinationals to the hilt, as I discovered on the streets around Dublin, where I met, among others, nurse Sean Robin, retiree Dennis Waring, and small hotel owner Joe Donohoe.
You have to find a way to survive, and if the way you do that is by attracting big international companies, then so be it.
Look, we're after being through a rough time. I'd say whatever we can do to get ourselves back on our feet, we'll do it.
If they pulled out, we'd be really rock bottom again.
Political and business leaders here dismiss any talk of a corporate exodus. They say the multinationals aren't here solely because of tax breaks. They've also come because of the workers, educated, intelligent, motivated and flexible. Qualities that could come in handy as the drive against tax avoidance gathers pace. In Dublin, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
We talked earlier in the program about housing costs here in California. We're going to take that national now. A couple of years before the financial crisis, Spencer Raskoff co-founded a company called Zillow, basically a website that gives you a bunch of data about real estate, specifically houses, like how many bedrooms or baths, stuff that's nearby, along with their guess at how much the house is worth, the cleverly branded Zestimate, the idea being that all that data might be handy if you're looking to rent or own. Today, Spencer Raskoff is the CEO of Zillow. He is also the guest on our regular series, Corner Office. Thanks for coming in the studio.
Thank you. Great to be here.
You have said in an interview I read before coming in here, you've said that this is a real estate media company. What does that mean?
It is. So what it means is that we have all this incredible information. It empowers consumers, and then we make money by selling ads. So we'll do about $1.5 billion of revenue this year, and it's advertising driven. So when you're looking at a home for sale, you'll see a couple buyer's agents next to that listing, and those are agents that are paying us to show up there and try to help you buy that house.
Here's the thing, though, about data and information and buying a home. Sure, yes, you want the data and you want to know what mortgage rates are and you want to know how close the schools are and you want to know what prior sales prices are. But there's an incredibly emotional aspect to buying a house. How do you put that into the algorithm?
Well, we've tried to infuse it into the brand. That's actually what Zillow means. Zillow is zillions of pillows. It's the data,
really?
the left brain aspect of real estate, and pillow is the squishy emotional, you know, where you rest your head at night side. So it comes through in the brand and the advertising and the brand positioning. In terms of into the product, the emotional side of home values doesn't factor into the Zestimate. I mean, the Zestimate is very much a mathematical algorithm that tries to figure out what every house is worth.
Where do you get that data, by the way, this estimate data? Because I will tell you, on my house, it's not right. I'm just saying, it's not right.
Sorry about
that. It's too low.
Of course. I never hear that. So the property attributes, bed, bath, square footage, tax assessment, that ultimately comes from county records, which we get directly from counties. Listing information we get from brokerages and multiple listing services. And then we get lots of other data from other sources, county records, crime data, school data, et cetera. And then the Zestimate is something that we produce on top of all that.
I want to talk about the housing market in this country in a second. But first, I want to take you back to not long after you guys started. You were 2.5-ish something years old. And then the housing market in this country goes kerflooey.
Yeah.
And not only is it bad for the housing market and the economy, it's bad for you as a company.
It was. Yeah. 2008 was very difficult for us as a company. We had layoffs. We went from about 200 employees to about 150. We really had to buckle down and try to make it through. And it wasn't clear whether we would survive or not as a company.
Do you, as you look now at housing in this country and the data that you have, actually, what do you make of the housing market?
It's hot. It is red hot. We're now past peak value in almost every city in the country. So that means we're above the 2007 peak that everyone talked about as a bubble. Today, what's driven home price appreciation is lack of inventory.
Yeah.
Through the recession, 2008 through 2011, yeah, there were hundreds of thousands of homes that were not built. Now, here we are almost 10 years later, and a couple million homes missing means just too much demand, not enough supply. Home values appreciate really quickly.
Do you impute any fragility in the red hotness of the housing market then?
No. I mean, the super high end has slowed down a little bit as there are fewer foreign buyers than there used to be 2 or 3 years ago. But the mid-level is still incredibly hot, especially the lower price tiers are very, very hot because home builders have basically given up on building entry-level homes. So the $200,000-$400,000 home, the new home just really doesn't exist anymore because labor's expensive, land's expensive. So home builders, when they build homes, they build more expensive homes. So there's very limited inventory at the low end.
And you guys are actually getting into the business of buying and selling yourselves.
We are. This is big news. Yeah. We started buying and selling houses in Phoenix and Las Vegas and later this year in other cities too.
How come? It seems a hair off the core competency.
It can seem that way at first. We look at it a little differently. As you point out, we're a data company, right? So what we have that no one else has is we have information on what houses people want to buy. And so we think that offering this service to the seller will allow us to match supply and demand between seller and buyer. So imagine a seller in this on-demand economy. Think about what you do on your smartphone. You press a button and magic happens. You press a button, the car arrives. You press a button, the food arrives. You press a button, you know, Amazon brings you things. Consumers want that type of convenience and ease. And so for the seller, we're trying to provide that convenience and ease where they take an all-cash offer without having to ready their home for sale.
In an economy where consumers are have a great tendency to do things perhaps without thinking, and I say this without aspersion to American consumers, do we want them doing transactions this size on their phones?
Yes, I think so. I think so.
Yes, because that's your business.
I think
but
so.
Come on, man.
Well, there's still a lot of consideration in the transaction, obviously. But for most people, lining up the sale of their home with the purchase of the next home is almost impossible, and it's a requirement for them to buy the next home. So we look at our service as basically providing liquidity to the seller so they can have an all-cash offer in hand for their existing home and then go buy their next home.
Spencer Raskoff at Zillow. Spencer, thanks a lot. Appreciate your time.
Thank you.
There's a whole lot more of my conversation with Spencer that we just didn't have time for on the radio, which seems to be a theme of the program today, by the way. Maybe we ought to be an hour. I don't know. We talked more about the housing market today, also what the run-up to the housing crash looked like on his end. It's on our Corner Office podcast. This final note on the way out, President Trump, as you've probably heard, has decided Congress didn't actually have to act for the White House to change or end its new policy on family separation at the border. He signed an order this afternoon that will let families who are detained together crossing the border stay together. There has been all kinds of pressure on the White House over its policy, and correlation is not causation. But today, American Airlines, United, Southwest, and Frontier all said they don't want the government to transport any of those separated children on their planes. All right, we got to go. Wall Street, as I said, mostly sideways today. Sarah Bruguer, Jake Gorski, Drew Josta, Jeff Peters, Dan Powell, Daniel Ramirez, Charlton Thorpe, and Ben Holliday engineer the broadcast for us. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.